Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with Bill Fink with another installment of Christogenos in our ongoing series on Two Seed Line in the New Testament. We completed a series on Two Seed Line in the Old Testament. And, you know, this ongoing discussion beginning, of course, with Matthew. And we're going to jump across Mark and go straight to Luke. But I just want to interject something before we get into Luke. I've been putting out a newsletter that contains five links to videos by different peoples concerning the Nephilim. And I was quite struck because I was doing research on the Enmity series, Genesis chapter 3. And I found that people like Chuck Missler and Mike Heiser, and I'm trying to think some other Patrick Heron, I believe he's Irish. All three of them have concurrent videos online talking about the Nephilim. And these guys are as close to Two Seed Line as you can possibly get without, you know, they misidentify the Adam of Genesis chapter 6, you know, daughters of Adam, and simply say, well, they're humans. But these are the daughters of Adam, folks. They're the Adamite, the women of Adam, and these Adamite women are the ones which the fallen angels cohabited with because they were fair, and the meaning of fair means white.
And it's important to note that Yahweh did not bring the flood upon that land because of the Nephilim, because of the children of the angels or whatever that mm-hmm. mingled with Adam. He brought the flood on the land to destroy the Adamites who were race mixing.
Right, right, yeah. And, of course, some of the Adamite women didn't have any say in the matter because they were being raped by these fallen angels. But, nevertheless, it had become, as you say, commonplace for the Adamites to engage in various kinds of race mixing. And,
well, you know, 100 women a day are raped by Negroes here in America.
Right.
And no black women are raped by white men.
Yeah, very rarely.
And,
yes.
So we're being raped by the Negroes.
Yes.
And at the same time, many of us are voluntarily having intercourse
yes.
with them.
Yes, yes. And I'm sure by the time of Noah, the voluntary part of it became part of the equation. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. And so that whole race of people, that mixed race hybrid people, and all three of these videos, they use the word hybrid. I can't ever remember any other Bible scholars except identists using that word hybrid with respect to Genesis 3 and 6. So,
right.
Yeah,
even Michael, you know, I don't know Michael. He's a Hebrew scholar, and I think he's a doctoral student.
He's a ufologist. Michael Heiser, yeah.
Well, he's also – I'm familiar with his work because he actually rebukes Zechariah Sitchin.
Right.
In many places. Because
yes.
Zechariah Sitchin is a Rockefeller agent and a fraud.
Yeah.
However, Michael Heiser, I don't know if he's German or Jewish.
Yeah.
And once you start connecting the Genesis 3 and Genesis 6 episodes to the children of Cain and the Kenites
right.
and trace them down through the Bible to the Jews –
yes.
That you'll meet all kinds of opposition.
That's right.
They might have the Nephilim thing right, but they don't want to admit the consequences.
Right. They won't admit the Cainite seed line. They don't want to go that far. And, of course, their books won't sell if they go that far. You know?
Oh, of course. Their books won't be published if
that's
they
right.
go that far.
That's right. Yeah, that's the bottom line on that. You know, and you don't have any Jews teaching to seed line.
No,
none whatsoever.
Not.
Despite the fact that our critics, the anti-seed line critics, you know, within Christianity and some of them within identity, they seem to think that this is a Jewish idea. The hell it is. You show me one rabbi that teaches two seed line.
Right. And
yeah.
you know, the Talmud alludes to things that are related to it.
Right.
But why wouldn't it?
Sure.
Why, if the Talmud alludes to just about everything in the Bible.
Right. Well, a lot of things in the Talmud are just there for shock value, you know.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That also.
Yeah, but there's not a single rabbi in the world who will go beyond saying, well, Eve may have cohabited with Shaitan, and then they'll just drop it there, and then they won't, you know, well, then maybe Cain, was the offspring of that illicit union. They won't go that far, and neither do the anti-seedliners.
No, they know the, the implications.
So the anti-seedliners have more in common with the rabbis than we do.
And a lot of the anti-seedliners, I mean, I just had intercourse with one of them yesterday. That's forbidden. We had a little correspondence.
Okay.
He knows the Jews are evil.
Yes.
And he takes it back to Esau.
Right.
But then they make a left-hand turn when you ask, you know, what's wrong with Esau?
Yes.
You know, why is Esau a fornicator? Why is he a profane person?
Mm-hmm.
And they take a left. They take a sharp left and run right into a wall.
Right. Well, I mean, it was the race of people that he married into who were the Canaanites, who were just as evil as the, they just changed their name from Canaanites to Edomites.
Well, right, because they're the children of incest and admixture with the Kenites and the Rephaim.
That's right, exactly.
And the Kenites and the Rephaim are the products of Genesis chapters 3 and 6.
Right, exactly.
Why would that stuff be in the Bible if it had no consequence?
If it had no meaning, yes.
It has an absolute meaning.
Yes, yes.
It's crazy to deny that.
Well, that's the part of the Bible that's fables, Bill.
Yeah, it's fables, all right.
Okay. All right, here we go. Luke, chapter 1, verse 1. I'm going to be reading today from, let me look at the edge of this here, the Life Application Study Bible.
This is a good one.
Yeah, it's supposedly from the work of Tyndale, but as I recall, Tyndale never completed the New Testament. So we'll see. Maybe
Tyndale, all right, his New Testament was translated from Latin.
Okay.
He did complete it. He did not complete the Old Testament.
Okay.
And other later people filled that in for him.
Uh-huh.
And that actually became the Bishop's Bible.
Okay.
But it was translated from Latin.
From Latin, okay.
And that, you know, it was replaced eventually by the King James and other Bibles translated from the Masoretic text and from the Greek, you know, late Greek manuscripts in the New Testament.
Right. So this translation, then, ladies and gentlemen, is twice removed from the original Greek, okay? So we'll see how that, you know, twice removing affects the translation. So here's how it reads, folks. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Many people have set out to write accounts about the events that have been fulfilled among us. They use the eyewitness reports circulating among us from the early disciples. Okay, I guess that's verses 1 and 2.
Yeah, that's a decent paraphrase.
Yes, okay. And then now you have a comment here about the Theophilus to whom Luke, is that, what verse is that in?
Well, it's verse 3.
Let me read the rest of it here then. Having carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I also have decided to write a careful account for you, most honorable Theophilus, so you can be certain of the truth of everything you were taught. Okay, so who's this Theophilus?
Well, there is no Theophilus.
Okay.
And the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Acts were both addressed to Theophilus, there's no doubt.
Okay.
And every single commentator that I've ever seen or heard, or translator, takes this to be a human person named Theophilus.
Right, it's capitalized, so it makes you think that it's a person. Yes.
Well, actually, in the Koine Greek, every letter Luke wrote was a capital.
Okay.
Okay? They didn't write.
Oh, I see.
They wrote in all capitals. That's Koine Greek was written in all capital block letters.
Okay.
And in a series with no spaces between words.
Right.
Now, here, usually when a person is addressed, the name is accompanied by the Greek the definite article.
Okay, yes.
Which does not exist here.
Okay.
Now, Theophilus is not a particular person.
Uh-huh.
Luke is using a literary device and addressing his reader as a lover of God.
Oh, okay.
And
yes.
He says, in my translation, it seemed good to also to me,
yes,
having closely followed from the first in all things accurately, to write to you methodically, most excellent lover of Yahweh,
uh-huh,
that you may decide concerning the certainty of the accounts which you were taught.
Right. So if a evangelical were translating this, he would substitute believer for Theophilus.
Yeah, well, yes. Yeah, but Luke is basically addressing any particular reader who is a lover of Yahweh.
Uh-huh, okay.
Otherwise, why would you be reading the gospel?
Right.
Unless
right.
You want to pervert it, like the like the Jews and the Paul bashers.
Right, right. Okay, so verse 5, when Herod was king of Judea, there was a Jewish priest named Zechariah.
Well, okay, yeah, go on.
Let me just finish the...
that we're Jewish.
Right, yeah, we'll clarify that. He was a member of the priestly order of Abiah, and his wife Elizabeth was also from the priestly line of Aaron. Zechariah and Elizabeth were righteous in God's eyes, careful to obey all of the Lord's commandments and regulations. They had no children because Elizabeth was unable to conceive, and they were both very old. So the very structure of describing Zechariah and Elizabeth as righteous means that they cannot have been Jews. They had to have been Judahites.
Yeah, right. Well, the word should always be Judean.
Right.
The word Jewish should not be in the New Testament or the Old.
Yes.
It should be Judahites or a man or a woman of Judah
right.
in the Old Testament.
Yes.
And it should be Judean in the New Testament.
Right.
It
right.
was a Roman political district with many races of people in it.
Right, right. And
I would like to say something about, a lot of people in Christian identity insist that Mary was somehow a Levite because of this account. And what this says is that Mary's cousin Elizabeth, her husband was a priest.
Yes.
Zacharias, and he was a priest and a Levite.
Yes.
But just because Mary's husband was married to a Levite, Mary's cousin
right.
had a husband that was a Levite, that doesn't make Mary a Levite.
Right.
That's crazy.
Right. Well, they make the mistake, I think, in one of the other accounts, Levi is her grandfather or father in one of the accounts, whether it's Matthew or Luke, I'm not sure. I think that's probably one of the reasons why they say that, too.
Well, that's also just another common name amongst the
right.
children of Israel.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean you belong to that tribe.
Right, yeah. So there's no proof that she's a descendant of the Levites, although she could have been.
In part she could have been, but she's a descendant of Judah, of the tribe.
Right.
Her lineage, her paternal lineage is the tribe of Judah.
That's right, right. And then it says here he was of the priestly line of Abiah, which was reestablished by Ezra and Nehemiah upon the return from the captives from Babylon.
Well, that was actually that was one of the courses.
Right.
He was of the course of Abiah, and
exactly.
they were the courses that David designated.
Yes. Yeah, but they were broken up during the Babylonian captivity, and then when they returned, they were reestablished.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah. So that the Judahite line of course priests, and there were 24 courses, this was still intact in the days of Jesus Christ. So, but these were temple servants who went about the daily business of, cleaning and preparing, et cetera, et cetera. They were not, you cannot equate these people with the Pharisees who were the official priesthood under Herod.
Well, they were, the Pharisee, to be a Pharisee, the Pharisees weren't an official priesthood per se. They were a political sect.
Yes.
They were a political and religious sect.
Yes.
As
yes.
opposed to the Sadducees, who were another political religious sect. And the Essenes were, in essence,
yes.
a political religious sect.
Yeah, although they didn't have much political power.
Right.
Not like the
Pharisees
two.
Had, and the Sadducees both had a lot of political power.
Yes.
And actually, if you examine Josephus, you'll find that the Sadducees were the party favored by the wealthy elite.
Uh-huh.
And they were the hardest on Christians.
Right.
That by far, they killed James the Lesser.
Uh-huh.
And they were very, they are named specifically as persecuting Christians in the book of Acts, and they're the ones that didn't believe in afterlife spirit. They were
right.
the democratic liberal atheists of their time.
Okay.
But they were also the party of the wealthy.
Uh-huh.
The Pharisees were the party of the middle class, really.
Okay.
And they were the majority in number, by far.
Yes.
However, the Sadducees had their say because they had money behind them.
Uh-huh.
Now, the Pharisees are really a political sect with enough power, and the Sadducees had some power, too. And there were a lot of high priests at the end of the king. In the last 40
yeah.
years in Jerusalem, a lot of the high priests were Pharisees.
Right.
Sadducees. A lot of high priests were Sadducees. And I tend to think that maybe Caiaphas and Annas here, I can't prove it, but I think maybe they were Sadducees,
okay.
and I've been wanting to do more research into Josephus, However, there are later high priests with those names that were definitely Sadducees,
right,
according to Josephus.
But suffice it to say that the Sanhedrin, which was the political religious ruling party under Herod...
Well, they were actually... The Sanhedrin is a council and of elders,
yes,
type of thing, and they had Sadducees and Pharisees both on them.
Exactly, exactly.
And Paul, you know, Paul in Acts, I think it's chapter 20 or 21,
yes,
when they have Paul on trial... The Judean, you know, religious authorities.
Yes.
Paul perceived that part of the group was Sadducees and part were Pharisees, and Paul perceived that it was the Sadducees who had the greater charges against him, the greater will to charge him,
yes,
and put him to death. So that's why he caused the division that he did by announcing that he was a Pharisee from a line of Pharisees, and that he, you know, he talked about the spirit and the afterlife. And that was a shot at the Sadducees to cause division in that,
right,
assembly,
right, yeah,
so that,
yeah,
he would get out with his skin,
right,
basically.
Right. Yeah, and then mixed up in all this are the true Judahites, who really didn't have that much power, who were trying to maintain the law of Moses. And that would include Abiah and Elizabeth.
The Edomites certainly had the king and the higher officials on their side.
Yeah.
You know, they had infiltrated all the high offices. They had the king and the whole king's family. They were all Edomites.
Yes.
And the wealthy people of the land were Edomites, and that's why they supported the Sadducees over the Pharisees.
Right.
And the Pharisees was probably, I mean, even from the New Testament, it seems to be a fairly divided group, where there are Pharisees that tip off Yahshua that Herod wants to kill him.
Uh-huh, right.
And they must have been good Pharisees.
Well, yeah, Nicodemus, you know, some of them may have quite likely were, in fact, Judahites, not Edomites.
Right, and
yes,
you could, I mean, it's hard to match it exactly to political parties today, but today we have the Democrats.
Yeah.
And they're liberals, and most of them are atheists.
Right.
And they are very much... I mean, 90% of the Jews, 90% of the Negroes, 65, 70% of the Latinos,
yes,
all are Democrats, identify, right, themselves as Democrats.
There you go.
And 90% of the Northeast Yankees.
Yeah.
The Republicans, a lot of them aren't any good either. A lot,
right,
of them are rich Jews. But you still have most of the religious people are more conservative and,
right,
tend to vote more Republican. And that's, you know, I mean, those lines are very vague in America still,
yeah,
but they are there.
Well, they
There's
were
no
actually,
doubt that they're there.
They were more defined, let's say, in the late 90s, because remember we had the contract with America where you had real conservative Republicans who believed in the Constitution on one side, and the liberal Republicans led by the Rockefellers, they would be your Sadducees, right?
Well, absolutely. The,
yes,
Rockefellers and the Schiffs and those people would be the Sadducees.
Right. So we have tremendous parallelism between politics and religion today compared with Judea in the time of Christ.
Absolutely.
Yes, very much so.
Absolutely. You could see the parallels,
yes,
all the time.
Yes. Okay, so let me start with verse 11 here. While Zechariah was in the sanctuary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him standing to the right of the incense altar. Zechariah was shaken and overwhelmed with fear when he saw him. But the angel said, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. God has heard your prayer. Your wife Elizabeth will give you a son, and you are to name him John. You will have great joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the eyes of Yahweh. He must never touch wine or other alcoholic drinks. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth." Any comment before I read verse 16?
Not yet.
Okay.
We'll go a few more verses.
Okay. "And he will turn many Israelites to the Lord their God." Now, I love this because it says Israelites. It doesn't say Jews. So this is a good translation, folks. "And he will turn many Israelites to the Lord their God. He will be a man with the spirit and power of Elijah. He will prepare the people for the coming of Yahshua. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and he will cause those who are rebellious to accept the wisdom of the godly." Any comments now?
Now, you know, the Paul bashers out of necessity also bash Luke.
Okay.
Okay, all the critics of Paul bash Luke because Luke is seen as Paul's,
right,
his scribe
left-hand
and his
man,
apostle, right? And he absolutely was.
Yes.
However, in reality, there is very much in Luke's gospel, which is found nowhere else in the New Testament, which absolutely buttresses the two seed line Christian identity message of truth.
Okay.
Therefore, so far as I'm concerned, any Paul basher who is not only anti-Paul and anti-Luke, but they're also anti-Christian.
Sure.
And
sure.
And this is witness number one in chapter out of four in chapter one of Luke that Luke understood. And let's say that Luke was a Greek. Luke was not a Hebrew.
Okay.
He was a physician. We're told he was a Greek, and we're told he was a physician.
Yes.
Okay. Now, being a physician proves that he was a Greek, because the Greco-Roman physicians served up all sorts of unclean foods for one to consume to cure his maladies.
Right.
Okay. And being a Hebrew precludes one from being a physician.
Okay.
Okay. Of the trade as the practice. As the trade was practiced by the Greeks and the Romans.
I see. Okay.
I'm sure there's ancient knowledge concerning herbs and
sure.
and various naturally occurring substances, which are good for certain maladies. There's
right.
no doubt.
Uh-huh.
However, being a Greco-Roman physician, a Hebrew could never be of that
right.
trade.
Yeah, but you're not saying that Luke couldn't have been of Hebrew heritage.
Oh, well, he was a Greek, so he was definitely an Israelite of dispersion.
Right, exactly.
There's no doubt.
Yes.
He was certainly either a Dorian or a Dan in Greek.
Yeah, but he was not a Judean in the sense of, a tribe of Judah at the time of Christ.
Right. Okay. I mean, he may have been we don't know what tribe he was from.
Uh-huh.
That can't be identified. It could be Dan. It could be Manasseh. I mean, they
right.
all settled in Asher. They all settled in those islands
right.
at one time or another. However, it's impossible to determine what tribe he was from.
Right.
And that's a lot of people claim they could do that, and it's I could talk about the dispersions, and it's just not possible.
Right, yeah. And here in verse 16, the fact that he refers to Israelites, this is a correct designation. But in verse 5, where it says Jewish priest, now Zechariah was an Israelite. He's being defined as an Israelite. And the word Jewish should simply be virtually in every case of the New Testament should be Judean, which
yes,
does
it's
not.
It's
a territorial designation. It has nothing to do with the religion.
And Judean actually is applied to Herod.
Okay, right.
In verse 5.
Yes.
So
yes.
In that one instance, Jewish would fit because Herod was an Edomite,
exactly.
But it still should not be translated Jewish.
Right, yeah, and so people have to keep in mind that wherever they see the word Jewish, in the Old Testament it simply does not belong, period. In the New Testament it can be used to apply to Edomites. It should never apply to the tribe of Judah, ever, because they were not Jews. They were,
right.
They were segregationists who practiced the law of Moses. Whereas everybody knows today, the Jews are integrationists who practice the Talmud. You cannot compare those two groups of people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, here in verse 1, in verse 16 in chapter Luke, we have the first of four proofs in Luke chapter 1 that Luke knew and wrote and taught, and Paul, whose gospel Luke's is, Paul absolutely taught that the covenants and the promises, Christ is the fulfillment of the covenants and the promises to the forefathers
yes.
that are specific to and exclusive to the children of Israel.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and let me just repeat the latter part of verse 17. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and he will cause those who are rebellious to accept the wisdom of the godly. So whose fathers and whose children are we talking? Well, we're talking about Israelites. That's the only designation that this, fathers and children could be.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
It says that the sons of Israel, shall he turn to Yahweh their God?
Right, right. And that unfortunately, Judeo-Christians today associate Jews with Israelites. And as we just explained, you cannot do that because the Jews have nothing in common with the Judahites or Israelites of the Bible. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Okay. Let me jump to verse 26 now. An angel promises the birth of Jesus to Mary. In the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a village in Galilee, to a virgin named Mary. She was engaged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of King David. Gabriel appeared to her and said, "Greetings, favored woman, the Lord is with you." Confused and disturbed, Mary tried to think what an angel could mean, what the angel could mean. "Don't be afraid, Mary," the angel told her, "for you have found favor with Yahweh. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you will name him Yahshua. He will be very great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his ancestor David, and he will reign over," who? "Israel, folks, forever. His kingdom will never end."
All right, well, the Greek says he will rule over the house of Jacob,
okay,
which is Israel. Okay, and this is proof number two that, I mean, it doesn't say he will rule over the house of Jacob and the Gentiles.
Okay, right.
Okay, it doesn't say he'll rule over the house of Jacob and any aliens or any
right.
foreigners.
Yes.
It says he shall rule over the house of Jacob.
Yes, and that can only mean the 12 tribes of Israel.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It can't mean anybody else.
That's right. So why do the churches all teach that Jesus came to save the entire world?
And this is proof number two.
Yes.
That Luke understood the exclusivity of the covenants.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me just continue here. Mary asked the angel, "But how can this happen? I am a virgin." The angel replied, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. So the baby to be born will be holy, and he will be called the Son of God. What's more, your relative Elizabeth has become pregnant in her old age. People used to say she was barren, but she's now in her 6th month, for nothing is impossible with Yahweh." Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. And John the Baptist was born, I mean, not quite as extreme a case as the case of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac.
Right.
But, I mean, here's a woman who's past her prime.
Right.
Who's considered to be sterile because she might be 40 or 50 years old and hasn't had a child yet.
Right, right. Yeah, so it seems like Yahweh has made a habit of picking older women who've been barren for a really long time to bear very important children.
Well, you know, in as an example, the children of Israel, our race, has been barren for a very long time before we produced a righteous kingdom.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and of course, the whole race was in the dispersion before becoming Christian. Right. So there's a lot of symbolism here, folks. Okay. Let me jump to verse 50 through 54. Mary responds to the news that she'll bear the Messiah. Okay. His mighty arm has done tremendous things. He has scattered the proud and the haughty ones. He has brought down princes from their thrones and exalted the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away with empty hands. He has helped his servant Israel, folks, Israel, and remembered to be merciful. Is there any hint so far in Luke? We covered Matthew already. We haven't discussed Mark. Is there any hint anywhere here that Israel, fleshly Israel, has been in some way discarded from the promises and the covenants?
Right, and this is telling us the exact opposite.
Yes.
That the promises and the covenants are only for Israel.
Yes.
And
yes.
That the coming of Christ is a fulfillment of all the promises to the fathers, to the patriarchs.
Yes.
Concerning Israel.
And to
period.
Yes, to absolutely verify what you just said, verse 55 says, "For he made this promise to our ancestors, to Abraham and his children forever."
Well, that's actually a pretty good rendition.
Yes.
All right, because I know the King James probably says Abraham and his seed,
uh-huh.
and then they try to spiritualize seed.
Right.
But
right.
I mean children, offspring. My translation has offspring.
Uh-huh.
And it says, just as he spoke to our fathers, to
right.
Abraham and to his offspring
right.
forever, or
well,
for the age.
Yeah, well, this
forever.
Is this is the Tyndale translation, so chances are Tyndale knew a bit more about it than your modern evangelicals do. Okay.
Well, you know, if you approach translation of the Bible with a clean mind and without church doctrine,
yes.
you're going to just translate the words.
Yes.
And you're going to do a hell of a lot better than any modern translator.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they all are loaded with church doctrines and pervert the words.
Yes.
Because they dispute them as they go along.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. And that's why the King James Version is actually so perverted in many places. You know, Tyndale, of course, came along before the King James, and he didn't have that kind of agenda. If anything, he was opposed to the oppression that was going on to dissenters at the time.
Well, I've never read the Tyndale version. I've never seen the value of reading it, only because, you know, I like to try to get as close as I can to the sources of information.
Sure.
And I, you know, I mean, I've read all the most ancient manuscripts of the New Testament.
Yes.
And in Greek.
Uh-huh.
And I never thought it very util to read a third hand, you know, I mean,
right.
This went from Greek through Jerome, who probably wasn't that bad, by the way, and I could talk about him too, into Latin,
right.
And then through Tyndale into English, and who knows how many emendators he's had, but this actually, I mean, what you've read so far, I'm pretty impressed with.
Yeah, it
sounds pretty good. I mean,
it definitely sounds better than the King James, no doubt about it.
There's a lot of places where it sounds, you know, because of the double translation, where it really sounds like a loose paraphrase.
Yes.
But I haven't been offended by the senses of any of the verses you've
yeah,
read so far.
Exactly.
Which the King James offends me all the time.
Yeah.
Because I can read the sense of the Greek, and the King
right.
James just isn't it.
Well, one thing about the King James that very few people understand, and I'm not going to accuse him of being a homosexual, as some people have done. I don't see any real evidence for that. But his translation, the reason he commissioned it was to overcome the prevailing notion in England at the time that the monarch, the ruling monarch, should submit himself to the will of God, and they were opposing, you know, his notion of the divine right of kings, that the king could do whatever he pleased with the power given to his office, okay? And so the people rebelled against this idea. And King James, one of the reasons for commissioning that Bible was to promote himself as, you know, the divine king. He could do anything he pleased simply because he was king. Okay? And
right.
A lot of people don't understand. That's why he commissioned the King James.
Some you know, medieval noblemen in Europe did a lot of vile things. Did you ever hear
yes.
the Law of the First Knight?
Pardon?
Did you ever hear the Law of the First Knight?
The Law of the First Knight?
Yes,
no.
The First Knight. When you take a wife,
the noble
of the estate gets her for the first time.
Right, yeah, I know what you mean.
Now, that actually, I can show you that very thing in the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Okay.
That's how old that is.
Yes.
It comes straight from Babylon.
Uh-huh.
That's where it came from, and they practiced it in medieval Europe.
Yes. Now I
okay.
see now I see the connection between Catholicism and Ishtar and Gilgamesh. Yes,
absolutely.
Because those were Catholic, Catholic feudal lords.
Well, that Law of the First Knight actually goes back to the Epic. I could show it to you in
yeah.
the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Very interesting. Yeah,
somewhere in my notes. It's nothing. You know, it's something I haven't wrote a paper on yet, but it
yeah,
is there.
Right.
And
most people in identity understand that the Catholic Church has simply borrowed lots of pagan, you know, symbolism and blended them together with Christian symbolism and created a bastard church. That's what they've done.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, and both in terms of racially bastardized and doctrinally bastardized the Holy Scriptures.
The Catholic Church, when Christianity was legalized, the political opportunists, and we know who they are,
yes.
came out of the woodwork and proceeded to replace the true Christian bishops with themselves and political patronage.
Right.
And that happened right from the time of Constantine,
yes.
there's no doubt.
Right.
And it began to happen right with the Nicene Fathers.
Right.
And some of them were probably political opportunists.
Yes.
Now the these political opportunists, as they converted pagans to Catholicism, they didn't care to depaganize them.
Of course not.
They didn't stand up against their pagan practices.
They just
and
wanted
the children,
subjects. Yes.
The children of Israel, what people don't, a lot of people even in identity don't realize is that Germanic paganism is Canaanitism.
That's right.
Germanic, I mean, when you look in the Bible You read the Book of Kings, the Book of Chronicles, the prophets. We were reading in a Bible study I do via Skype with some of the brethren in Louisiana. We were reading last night from Isaiah, and it was talking about worshiping trees in sacred groves.
Right.
Well, that's what these neo-pagans do today.
Oh, Tannenbaum, oh, Tannenbaum.
Well, exactly. That's part of it. But this is a lot of people, if you bring that up today, they would identify. You go to Stormfront, talk about that, they'll think you're a neo-pagan.
That's right. That's right.
And, well, you're really a Canaanite. It's a Canaanite religion that our ancestors took to Europe with them.
Yeah, that's what they don't understand, that the Israelites were banished by Yahweh from that territory because they were engaging in pagan Canaanite practices.
And they continue to do that.
That's right.
And a lot of them still continue to do that.
It's called Beltrain. They still do it in England. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so modern paganism, folks, if you're not aware of it, is even they think it's an Aryan tradition.
And it's Canaanite.
It's Canaanite. It goes all the way back to 745 B.C. when Yahweh banished the 10 northern tribes for their pagan rituals. That's how old it is, folks. It's not just Odin. Odin was practicing Canaanite rites, whether he realized it or not. Okay.
Well, let me tell you something. You know, let me tell you something about his name, Odin.
Okay.
First, it's a D and an N with a vowel sound in front of it and between the two. I mean, it's the same word, basically, as Adon, which means Lord in Hebrew.
Okay, yes. Yes, okay.
Now, aside from that, in all of the Saxon Chronicles, I mean, I've read Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons, and he quotes very heavily and gives hundreds of citations from the Saxon Chronicles, which are these chronicles of the kings of Northern Europe and England that go all the way back to the actual chronicles themselves sitting in the Bodleian Library in Oxford University are from the 6th century.
Okay.
These manuscripts.
Yes.
They date to the 6th century. And they talk about Odin. And all of these Germanic kings counted their lineage in how many generations they had between themselves and Odin.
Right.
11th generation from Odin, 9th generation from Odin.
Yes.
And all of the Saxon kings did that, and the kings of Sweden and Denmark. And it very well seems that there was a historical king named Odin who probably lived around the middle of the third century.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and he was famous for fighting against the Romans, and he defeated them in many battles. So he was a very valiant warrior. No doubt about it.
Later on, he was deified,
yes.
And one of the guests in the forum has that correct.
Yes.
He, just like we are so prone to deifying our ancestors.
Yes.
And to deifying great warrior. And our race has done that from the beginning.
Yes, we're good at that, aren't we? But we should only be deifying one person, right?
Right, one ancestor,
yes,
Yahweh.
Exactly. Okay. All right, now, let me just, before I go to into chapter 2, I just want to quote verse 80 of chapter 1 because...
Well, I think we really have to get to verse 167.
Okay. All right, well,
we left off basically at 154, 56 in there, didn't we?
Right. Yeah. Okay. According to your notes, it doesn't include that, but I'll just start reading at 67, Zechariah's prophecy. Okay.
I must have missed it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
When I made my notes.
All right. Then his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and gave this prophecy. Praise the Lord. The God of Israel, okay, folks, there's that word Israel again. It doesn't say the God of the Jews. You know, I wonder if that expression, God of the Jews, I don't think that occurs in the Bible either, because he has visited and redeemed his people. Who did he redeem? The Africans?
No.
The Malaysians? The Indians of East India? The Orientals? No. Who are his people, folks? He came to redeem Israel. He didn't redeem anybody else. He has sent us a mighty Savior from the royal line of his servant David, just as he promised through his holy prophets long ago. Now we will be saved from our enemies, and our enemies pretend to be us, okay, and from all who hate us. Wow, this sounds like a physical salvation. Of a race of people, doesn't it?
Well, it absolutely is. And here is the fourth witness in Luke. The fourth time Luke has mentioned this in chapter 1.
Yes.
That salvation, redemption, Yahweh, all of this is only for Israel. Yahweh is the God of Israel.
Yes.
Luke says it several times here. There's nothing about aliens. There's nothing about folding in other tribes. There's
spiritual
nothing about
Israelites.
Gentiles.
Yes.
There's nothing about spiritual sperm.
Yeah, right.
There's nothing. This is all, and this is Luke, and he's a Greek.
Yes.
And the Paul bashers that deny Luke do so.
Right.
To satisfy the Jews. I mean, they're playing into the hands of the Jews.
Well, because they falsely categorize Luke as a Gentile.
Right, but you don't find this in Matthew's gospel.
Right.
You don't find this message of exclusivity in Matthew's gospel. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There's only one line in Matthew's gospel that guarantees that Christianity is exclusive, and that's 15:24.
Okay.
And there's a hint of it in Matthew 10. But you don't find this over and over again in Matthew's gospel four times in one chapter.
Right.
That this is only for the children of Israel. And all of these are referrals to prophecy in the Old Testament.
Yes.
And all of it is referrals to the promises given to the fathers. And it states that explicitly.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And
there's no doubt that without Luke, we'd have a big problem teaching Christian identity. With Luke, this is extremely clear, and it's going to get clearer in chapter 2.
This is very clear. I mean, it's exclusive. It doesn't include anybody but the Israelites in this narrative. It simply doesn't.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And the Paul bashers are really fools. They're just fools.
Well, I think that's because they've been deceived by the Jewish definition of the word Gentile, okay?
Well, they've been deceived by a lot of things.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
You know, a lot of them have been in identity, have claimed to have studied for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, how long can you study and still be deceived?
Right. Well, they've been deceived by, who's the South African guy? Finlay?
W.G. Finlay.
Finlay. And
who openly admits getting his sources for his criticism of Paul from Joaquin Prince,
right.
Who's a Jew,
yeah.
Who's a rabbi from Newark, New Jersey.
Right. Well, the rabbi must know, right? I have to say, I was a tremendous, and I still am, a tremendous admirer of W.G. Finlay. I have probably the best collection of the Covenant Message. I have stacks of the Covenant Message, which he published for a good 20 years, okay? In my library, I probably have the best collection outside of Africa.
It might all be great, but as soon as you start following the Jews, that all goes out the window.
Well, of course. And I was just utterly amazed when he started Paul bashing. And I just couldn't believe it. I said, how can you not perceive that Paul is an exclusivist, just like the rest of the Bible? You know?
Well, here's through chapter 1, four times. Luke definitely proves that he's an exclusivist.
Yes.
And he's not even a Hebrew. I mean, he can't make a claim to be a Judean.
Right. Right, but he's an Israelite of the dispersion. He obviously knows it.
Well, he's definitely an Israelite of the dispersion, and we'll get to that. When we get to Timothy, you know, when we talk about Timothy and Titus, who Timothy was half a Greek, and Titus was a Greek,
right.
And Paul calls them pure children of the faith, according to the popular belief.
Right, yeah, and so for those people who haven't listened to us discuss this before, the word Gentile is Latin, and it means kinsman. It does not mean the opposite of kinsman as it is popularly understood.
We're going to find that out when we get to 229 here.
The true definition of the Latin and French gentilis is one of your own race. It cannot possibly be translated as non-Israelite, folks. That's simply a false translation. Okay, verse 72. He has been merciful to our ancestors. Whose ancestors? Not to anybody but Israel, folks. By remembering his sacred covenant. To whom did he make the covenants, folks? The covenant he swore an oath with to our ancestor Abraham. We have been rescued from our enemies so we can serve God without fear in holiness and righteousness for as long as we live. And you, my little son, will be called a prophet of the Most High, because you will prepare the way for the Lord. You will tell his people how to find salvation through forgiveness of their sins. Now, interesting, folks. Of course, in Christianity, the concept of forgiveness is very much in the forefront. It's probably one of the most important teachings of Christianity. Where do you find that in Judaism? Do you find any teaching of forgiveness in Judaism at all? And if not, why not? Because they claim to be, you know, the preservers of the oracles of the Old Testament, which also teaches forgiveness. Yet I don't hear any Jews talking about forgiveness.
Absolutely not. Jews don't talk about forgiveness because they have the Nal Kidre. They forgive themselves once a year.
That's right.
They have no sin. They forgive themselves.
They forgive themselves before they commit the crime.
They're their own God.
That's right.
They have no God but themselves, and they forgive themselves.
Yes, and that's the extent of their concept of forgiveness. It's self-forgiveness.
That's what Judaism is.
Yes. Verse 78, because of God's tender mercy, the morning light from heaven is about to break upon us, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, and to guide us to the path of peace. John grew up and became strong in spirit, and he lived in the wilderness until he began his public ministry to Israel.
And that's it. And you're reading it. I mean, it sounds pretty good. I mean,
there's
a couple of places that it's a loose paraphrase. However, it's still the exclusive message shines through.
Right. It shines through very clearly. And I'd say this translation is certainly so far better than the King James, and that doesn't have the archaic language that the King James is often.
Well, this is evidently an updated Tyndale.
Yeah, this is
updated. An original Tyndale wrote in the 14th century.
Right.
And his original English, I'm sure, would be very archaic even compared to the King James.
Right, yeah. So this edition of the Tyndale Bible is actually very readable. Okay. Chapter 2, verse 1. At that time, the Roman Emperor Augustus decreed that a census should be taken throughout the Roman Empire. Okay. Wasn't it Tiberius? Was Augustus alive at the time of John? This has got to be run.
No. At the birth of John the Baptist, it was
Tiberius.
Augustus.
No? It was?
Augustus.
Okay.
It was Tiberius at the beginning of the ministry.
Okay.
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 Verse 2. I'm sorry, chapter 2, verse 1, and it happened in those days that came out a decree from Caesar Augustus to register the whole inhabited world.
Okay.
Okay.
The Roman Empire, yes.
This first registration happened while Quirinius was the governor of Syria, and all had gone to be registered each to his city. We're talking about the birth of Christ here, not the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist.
Right, okay.
Okay?
Right. Okay, sorry.
Tiberius became the emperor in 14 B.C.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, 14 AD.
Yes.
14 AD. And right now the year is about 2 B.C.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I was jumping ahead in my mind. Okay, so let me jump, because you quoted verse 2, let me jump to verse 3. All returned to their own ancestral towns to register for this census, and because Joseph was a descendant of King David, he had to go to Bethlehem in Judea, David's ancient home. Okay, anything here? This is really clear and obvious. We're talking about Judahites here, ancestral Judahites, and we're not talking about the Edomites that were incorporated into Judea 125 years earlier. These people are ancestral Judahites, no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There were still a lot of them left,
yes,
especially in Galilee.
Right, especially in Galilee. And there were probably a lot in Jerusalem, too, but they had become cosmopolitan, like our friends in New York City. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, look at New York. I mean, they all call it Jew York.
Yes.
But there aren't too many there is a synagogue in this town, but it's a small one, and there aren't hardly anybody goes to it.
Yes.
It's probably there for three lawyers and a doctor that live in this town.
That's right.
But, I mean, most of upstate New York is pretty much Christian, especially the rural areas.
Yes.
But down in the city, down in Jerusalem,
yes,
there's nothing but Jews and aliens.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million Jews in New York City, and the rest of them are...
Yes,
well be.
And they're Judaized, whatever. Yes. Okay, he traveled there from the village of Nazareth in Galilee. He took with him Mary, his fiancée, who was now obviously pregnant. Okay, any comments in these verses here?
We will we could comment on them now.
Yes.
They were betrothed.
Right.
And that means that, right, that's the modern equivalent of a fiancé.
Right, right. And so, go ahead.
And she, her being pregnant is an exact reversal of what happened to Adam and Cain and Eve.
Right, right.
He accepted a woman that was pregnant. I mean, Mary was pregnant by Yahweh, but
yes.
He accepted a woman who was pregnant from somebody else.
Right, yeah, Adam had to do the same thing, right. And,
absolutely.
Yes.
I'd like to talk a little about the history here. Caesar Augustus here is Gaius Octavius, and he was actually the nephew of Julius Caesar who adopted him.
Okay.
And he became Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, and he ruled Rome as part of a triumvirate from 43 B.C. This guy was on the throne in Rome forever.
Yes.
Which ended in the civil war with Mark Antony, all right, culminating at the Battle of Actium in 31 B.C.
Right.
From 27 B.C., Octavian, this Caesar Augustus, was the sole emperor of Rome.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Now, this decree that he issued was probably to celebrate Rome's 750th year.
Okay.
Which would have been 2 B.C., which was probably the year that Yahshua Christ was born.
Okay.
And I'll talk about more about that as we proceed through Luke chapters 2 and
yes.
3.
Yes, okay. So these dates can be verified by cross-checking battles and, ascendancies to thrones, et cetera, so that these dates can be verified. This is not, this is not just guesswork here. Okay? That's what you're saying, right?
Right. All of these dates are verified. Everything here, Luke
yes.
was a historian.
Yes.
Unlike any of the other gospel writers.
Right. Go ahead.
Matthew wrote the accounts of what happened, but he didn't really tie it to any anchors
right.
that we can measure in secular history.
Right. And since he was a Greek, he was able to – I'm sorry. He was a dispersed Israelite. Okay. And that he was able to make these connections that Matthew, Mark, and John, since they were, brought up and raised in the area of Galilee, they couldn't have made those associations.
Well, right. They were, for the most part, they were unlearned tradesmen.
Yes.
And Luke is a very learned man. He was very skilled in the art of writing. His writing is extremely eloquent. I think my translation of Luke 1 verses 1 through 4 is pretty good
uh-huh.
because I think I tried to reflect Luke's eloquence, but it's extremely eloquent writing.
Yes.
And I don't think I could really do it justice, but it's his Greek is very, very learned.
Yes, yes. Well, you just have to come up with flourishes, like Farrar Fenton likes to do. Okay, so verse 6, and while they were there, the time came for her baby to be born. She gave birth to her first child, a son. She wrapped him snugly in strips of cloth and laid him in a manger because there was no lodging available for them. First child. I don't have my King James in front of me, but I don't think it's translated first child in the King James. What do you have?
No, which verse is that exactly?
This is verse 6.
She gave birth to her firstborn. I mean, the word child is intoned, but it's
okay.
not really, it's not there. She gave birth to her firstborn.
Okay.
Her firstborn son.
Yeah.
I'm not reading past my footnote.
This translation certainly implies that she had more children.
Well, she absolutely
yes.
had more children.
Yes.
I mean, it talks, where it talks about the brethren of the Lord later in the book. Not all his disciples. I mean, the Catholics try to say, they're called brethren because they're his disciples.
Yes.
But then what would be the use of the distinction?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody in the crowd would be his brethren.
That's right.
But it says in some places explicitly that his brethren stood outside by the door.
Yeah.
Now, there's a room full of Christians, and his brethren are standing outside the room, out of the room outside by the door?
Yeah,
the Catholics are absolutely mad.
Yeah, that's right.
They've got to be on drugs to believe their own teaching.
Yeah, what's the difference between a Christian and a brother then?
Right.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
His brethren, Mary went on and probably had 3 or 4 or 5 more because he had sisters too.
Yes.
Five more children maybe.
Yes.
Because he had at least 3 brothers.
Uh-huh,
and he had at least one or two sisters mentioned.
And so these brethren were literal brethren, folks. Brothers, literal brothers and sisters, yes. Okay.
Well, if you're in a room full of Christians and your brother is standing outside by the door,
yeah, right.
Well, that must be used in the filial sense and
yes.
Not in the spiritual sense.
Right, exactly. Yeah, or the religious sense, yes.
Well, right, that's what I tried to say. And it's absolutely clear that they were Mary's children.
Right.
Now, they were always with Mary.
Yes, yes. Now, verse 11, I really would like the Joseph Scepter people to read. The Savior, yes, the Messiah, the Lord, has been born today in Bethlehem, the city of David. Any doubt about that? I mean, if you question this, you're questioning the validity, and of course, all the Gospels say that.
Well, I'm gonna say this. There is a serious problem with the Joseph Scepter people with their own writing.
Okay.
Because when I first started writing those people back in maybe 2003 and disputing with them, and when Clifton first started his Joseph Scepter heresy essays, which I assisted him with to some degree.
Okay.
The Joseph Scepter people were denying that Christ was a descendant of David.
Right.
Okay. But after they debated and got letters from myself and especially from Clifton, all of a sudden Christ was a descendant of David, but David was of Ephraim because he was an Ephrathite.
Right.
They shifted their position, and I got the letters from Russell Walker to prove that in my paperwork.
Okay.
I do have those letters that I saved from Russell Walker.
Yes.
They shifted their position when they were exposed and changed their story.
Right. Right. They changed their story just like the Holocaustians do.
Okay. Well, right. They do it all the time. Anybody that's lying is going
right.
to
well,
say
I mean,
something different 6 months from now than he's saying today.
Right. I mean, if you contradict Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you're in serious trouble.
Well, I don't even think the Joseph Scepter people, they're not Christians.
Right.
They're
right.
Jews, too. They may as well be.
Yeah, well, I don't think they. Yeah, I don't think they consider themselves to be Christians. The ones that I know don't refer to themselves as Christians.
No, they're Yahweh. They claim to be Yahwehs.
Right.
They're Yahweh.
Yeah.
They're Jews.
Yeah, and so they deny much of the history that's contained in the New Testament, and which is saying, well, you might as well just throw the New Testament out. Well, how can you be a Christian if you throw the New Testament out? You can't be. Okay, verse 12. And you will recognize him by this sign. You will find a baby wrapped snugly in strips of cloth lying in a manger. Suddenly the angel was joined by a vast host of others, the armies of heaven, praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest and peace on earth to those with whom God is pleased. Okay, so these are literal angels, folks.
now that talks actually a pretty good translation, because it's peace upon the earth among approved men.
Okay.
Is what the Greek says.
Very interesting.
And I don't know what the King James says there. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. We won't bother with the King James today. You know. Okay. All right, now let me jump to verse 25, the prophecy of Simeon. At that time, there was a man in Jerusalem named Simeon. He was righteous and devout and was eagerly waiting for the Messiah to come and rescue Israel. Okay. Not spiritual Israel, not believers, folks, but Israel. The Holy Spirit was upon him and had revealed to him that he would not die until he had seen the Lord's Messiah. John Hagee, you better be listening.
Oh, yeah, John Hagee's he's another Jew.
Yeah. That day the Spirit led him to the temple, so when Mary and Joseph came to present the baby Jesus to the Lord, as the law required, they were law-abiding Judahites, folks. They weren't Jews. They were law-abiding, the law of Moses, not the tradition of the elders, as we found out about in Matthew. Simeon was there. He took the child in his arms and praised God, saying, Sovereign Lord, now let your servant die in peace, as you have promised. I have seen your salvation, which you have prepared for all people. He is a light to reveal God to the nations, and he is the glory of your people, Israel.
Now, there's a serious problem with this translation. It's no better than the King James.
Okay.
I'm going to read the King James here. I just got it out.
All right.
And I'm going to read from verse 30. For mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel.
Okay.
Now, I have a
Gentiles. Okay.
Well, I have a serious problem with the Tyndale translation first in verse 31.
Okay.
Because verse 31 says, which you have prepared in front of all the people.
Okay.
Not in front of all peoples.
Right.
Okay, the word people is singular there.
Okay.
It's not plural.
Right, okay.
And in Greek,
the people of Israel.
The word laos is a people as a unit.
Uh-huh.
It's a homogeneous ethnicity. It cannot be, the word laos cannot ever be taken in Greek to mean people of more than one race or ethnicity.
Right.
Because in those cases, in the New Testament, that's when the word ethnos is used in the plural.
Right. Okay.
Okay? When it's when we're addressing in Greek in the New Testament period,
okay,
multiple people, Judeans and Greeks stay in one room,
yes,
in one synagogue. That's where Paul says, I will go to ton ethnon, meaning to the nations of people in that room.
Right, right.
And it's translated people in those cases.
Right, okay.
Okay? Or it's properly translated people,
right,
in those cases. Now, verse 32 is, it has much greater problems, and we're going to probably spend the next 20 minutes on this verse.
All right, okay.
Okay? A light to lighten the Gentiles.
Okay.
That's what the King James says.
Well, let me repeat the Tyndale version here, because it's not quite that bad. He is a light to reveal God to the nations, okay?
Well, that's just as bad.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And he is the glory of your people Israel. You know, so that clarifies it, okay, if there's any doubt about the first clause. But go ahead.
Okay, the words in Greek, the word for light is phos, okay? And phos is a noun, and that's translated a light correctly in the King James and in the Tyndale version.
Okay.
But the next word is apokalupsin, and that's a noun. And both Tyndale and the King James have it as a verb.
Okay.
And it cannot be a verb.
Okay, you're talking about the word reveal as translated,
yes,
here. Okay.
It's to reveal in the Tyndale version you just read.
Yes.
It's to lighten in the King James.
Yes.
Now, to lighten, that's a verb, no?
Yes.
Well, apokalupsis is a noun.
Okay.
There's a serious problem there.
All right.
The King James translated a noun as a verb.
Okay.
How did they do that?
If
especially,
good question.
Especially if they're inspired.
Yes.
Okay, the bozos that think that the King James is inspired, I can't say enough bad things to describe
right,
how stupid they are.
I know you can't. Yes.
It's just incredible.
Okay.
That people that claim this book, this King James version of the Bible, which
right,
was an official government translation.
Yes.
And we've never seen anything good be an official government anything.
There you go.
Okay.
Yes.
It was an official government translation in 1611.
Uh-huh.
It was decreed by the king as the only legal translation in all of England.
Right.
That nobody else was allowed to have any different translation. And they're saying today, 300-400 years later, that it's inspired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was forced down people's throats.
Sure it is. Sure it is. Yes. Okay, so what is the correct and proper translation of
this
clause? Well,
first, the words in Greek, the first word is a noun. It's phos. It means a light.
Okay.
The second word, and it's in the nominative case, which means that it's the subject of the sentence.
Yes, the light. Yes.
Okay? The second word is apokalupsin. That's the accusative case of the word apokalupsis, which is the word apocalypse.
Apocalypse, yes.
It
revelation.
Means a revelation.
Yes.
And here it's in the accusative case, which means it's the subject of the clause.
Okay.
Okay. Now the next word, the Gentiles or the nations,
uh-huh,
is not in the accusative case, so it can't be a subject of any clause.
Okay.
It's in a genitive case.
Ah, okay.
And the genitive case denotes source or possession.
So it modifies. So which noun does that actually modify then?
Well, the proper reading, it's modifying apokalupsin, which is in the accusative. The proper reading is a light for a revelation of the nations.
Okay.
And honor of your people Israel.
Okay.
A light for the revelation of the nations.
Okay.
The gospel revealed who the nations of Israel were.
Right.
Where
right.
did it go? It
right.
went to Europe. What did those nations become? Christendom.
Right.
This is why Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that they were the proof of the good message.
Yes, yes.
Because they believed the gospel of Christ.
Yes.
And they became Christians.
Okay.
Israel was supposed to believe, according to the prophets, the gospel of Christ and follow Yahweh.
Yes. Right. Well,
which is exactly what we did when we became Christians.
Yeah, the Messiah was promised to Israel and to nobody else, okay? So that what you're saying then is that since the Christians are the ones who accepted the Messiah, they obviously are the Israelites.
Absolutely.
Okay?
And they knew it.
Yes, yes.
And,
well,
and you know, Paul, this goes hand in hand with so much in Paul's epistles, this
mm-hmm.
statement. Once this statement is translated correctly, all right, the correct translation of Luke 2:32 is a light for the revelation of the nations and honor of your people Israel.
Okay.
Now, Paul told the Romans, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well,
Paul told the Romans that the promise to Abraham was that his descendants would become many nations.
Right.
And
right.
the righteousness of Abraham was that Abraham believed Yahweh when he was told his descendants would become many nations.
Yes. yes.
And that's defined, and it's explained by Paul in Romans chapter 4. Okay? Paul says that the promise to Abraham and Abraham's righteousness was that he believed that his descendants would become many nations. And here we have Luke saying, and actually Simeon is saying it, and Luke is recording it, that Yahshua Christ would be a light for the revelation of those very nations
yes.
promised to Abraham.
Yes. Okay.
Period.
All right. So what about...
So what I'm saying is that the identity message is a hell of a lot clearer
yes.
when you have a correct translation,
right.
which is not in the King James Version of the Bible.
Okay. Now, the preposition here is to in the Tyndale translation, and should we make a big deal about the to versus of? Because of is of used in the filial sense? Because I know the Greek has a very strong filial definition of the word of, as meaning as
well, there is
of
no,
a certain person, of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, meaning direct descendants of.
There is no preposition before the word nations in the Greek manuscript.
In the okay.
Okay.
Okay, so two.
But
is,
the word is in the genitive case.
Yes.
Which denotes source or possession.
Yes. Belonging
okay.
to. Belonging to. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Very
the
good.
The revelation is of the nations. We're revealing the nations.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's
mm-hmm.
going on here.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Yeah, because even your translation, without that explanation, yeah. So read your translation again so people can get the full thrust of the meaning there. Okay?
A light, that comes from the Greek word phos.
Okay.
For, that comes from the Greek word eis, which means for.
Mm-hmm.
The revelation, which comes from the Greek word apokalypsis, which is a noun and not a verb.
Right.
of the nations.
Okay.
Which comes from the genitive form
yes.
of the Greek word for ethnos.
Yes.
The genitive plural of the nations. That's what it means.
Of the nations
a light
of Israel.
Or the revelation of the nations and honor of your people Israel.
Right. Very good. Very good. So this, so your translation puts the grammar, the correct grammar, into its proper place. And
my translation is perfectly correct grammar.
Yeah.
I could explain every word.
And you have. You have. It just shows that, you know, this the Tyndale translation, which has, in my opinion, really surpassed many of the King James translations I've read, okay? Yet the prepositions and the placement of nouns, adjectives, and verbs is all messed up. It's all messed up. And so it leads us to believe that the to the nations, which means non-Israel nations to most people who read this, okay, they're getting the wrong impression. It doesn't mean anything of the kind.
If it said to the nations, then the word ethnos would have to be in the dative case.
Okay.
And it's not. It's in the genitive case.
Okay. So,
this is all very clear. Greek has very clear rules.
Yes.
And the King James Version is dead wrong.
Right.
And you can't take a verb and translate it as a noun.
Yeah.
Or a noun and translate it as a verb.
Right. Exactly.
Can't be done.
Yes. Okay. Very good. All right. Let me just continue in verse 33. Jesus' parents were amazed at what was being said about him. Then Simeon blessed them, and he said to Mary, the baby's mother, "This child is destined to cause many in Israel to fall, but he will be a joy to many others. He has been seen as a sign from Yahweh, but many will oppose him. As a result, the deepest thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your very soul." In other words, as Messiah promised, he would be a factor of division in Israel.
Right. You know, I read this quite differently.
Okay.
And I could defend my Greek.
Yes.
Then Simeon blessed him and said to Mary and his mother, "Behold, he is set for a fall and a restoration of many in Israel."
Yes. Beautiful.
Okay.
Yes.
"And for a sign," and the King James really screws this up here, because the King James takes a deponent medium voice present participle verb,
yes,
and they translate it as a passive verb.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
And for a sign speaking in opposition is what it says.
Okay, yes.
Okay,
as
he
opposed
is
to
the sign
from God,
speaking,
yes,
in opposition.
Uh-huh.
That's what's going on here.
Yes, yes.
Okay? And a deponent medium voice verb can't be translated as a passive. I'm
right,
sorry.
Yeah. So they're getting the grammar messed up again.
Well, they twist it into their theology.
Yeah, right, right.
Is what goes on.
Yes, yes. And it's not like you're being really picky here. You're pointing out some blatantly obvious...
a noun translated as a verb is,
yeah,
blatant.
That's right.
I mean, this could be an honest mistake.
Yeah.
You know, the forms of some of these Greek verbs are pretty complex.
Yes.
And I got to look a lot of them up sometimes when I translate. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, sure.
And
well, they should have,
I mean,
looked them up too, shouldn't they?
Well, yeah, they should have.
Right.
Yeah, they should have.
Uh huh. Very, very good. Okay. All right. So let me continue here, because I know you want to talk about Anna and of the tribe of Asher, verse 36. "Anna, a prophet, was also there in the temple. She was the daughter of Phanuel from the tribe of Asher. And she was very old. Her husband died when they had been married only 7 years. Then she lived as a widow to the age of 84. She never left the temple, but stayed there day and night, worshiping Yahweh with fasting and prayer. She came along just as Simeon was walking with Mary and Joseph, and she began praising God. She talked about the child to everyone who had been waiting expectantly for God to rescue Jerusalem." So it's pretty obvious here, even from, you know, this translation, which is, you know, very smooth. I love the translation, whether it's correct or not. But it's obvious that these Israelites understood that they were in the presence of the Messiah.
Well, you know, from what absolutely. There's no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
There is no doubt they knew, and I'll get to that in my notes in the next chapter, in chapter 3.
Okay.
But there is, and we'll talk about Daniel's 70-week prophecy a little.
Yes,
and,
okay.
But here, in fact, let me do that a little now.
Okay.
And, you know, and to all those awaiting redemption in Jerusalem is the way I translate the end of verse 38.
Okay.
And we've also seen Simeon at verse 25 was expecting the consolation of Israel.
Yes.
Daniel's 70-week prophecy, and I'll date it, and I'll show the exact dates when we get to you know, next week probably.
Okay.
The chapter 3. However, Daniel's 70-week prophecy found in Daniel 9, 24 through 27 had to be understood in some degree and by these people.
Yes.
And there was a messianic expectation throughout the region at the time.
Okay.
I mean, the Samaritan woman at the well in John 4:25 tells Christ, "I know when the Messiah comes, that the Messiah cometh, and when he comes, he will teach us all things."
Yes.
She was awaiting a Messiah.
Yes.
At that time, she testified,
yes,
that she expected him in her lifetime.
Right, right. Okay.
And the as he chose the apostles walking through Galilee, I think it's in the beginning of Mark's gospel or the beginning of John's, one or the other, and they said, "We have found the Messiah.
Right.
They didn't ask him.
Right.
They just knew it was him.
That's right.
It's pretty plain.
Yes.
And they knew from roughly what Daniel's 70-week prophecy was intoning was that right around this time the Messiah was going to come, and they could count the years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only place in any Old Testament scripture. I mean, the Magi talk about seeing his star.
Right.
But I don't find that in scripture. I mean, maybe I'm just not a seer or a prophet.
Well,
I can't
it could have been a miracle, you know, designed to capture their attention. Yeah.
Well, right, but they knew that star denoted his birth.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that there must be some lost writing.
Yes.
Okay,
sure,
that we don't have anymore that they knew that from.
Right.
But Daniel's 70-week prophecy is not lost.
Right.
And Daniel dated the coming of Christ right to the year.
Right. Now, I just want to contrast something we mentioned about Matthew, and that is the contrast between these Israelites, these Judahite Israelites of Judea, and their joy at the coming of the Messiah, contrasting that with the hatred experienced by Herod when he found out that the Messiah had been born.
Absolutely. And not only Herod, but all of Jerusalem with him feared.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, that's just like if you announced it in New York City today.
Yeah, that the Messiah was walking down Broadway.
There would be three or four happy Irishmen.
Yeah.
And every Jew, Puerto Rican, and Negro in the city would tremble.
That's right.
That's what
right.
would happen.
Exactly, exactly. All right. Okay, so now what about Anna and Asher?
Okay.
Yes.
A lot of people fault Luke. Oh, how the 12 tribes of Israel, they were all taken away. How could somebody of the tribe Asher be there?
Yes.
And I'll explain that. Because when the Assyrians came, they took all of the Israelites out of the land, and they took 46 fenced cities of Judah.
Yes.
And we see quite often mentioned that the inhabitants of Jerusalem were left behind, and that's true. But the inhabitants of Tyre were also left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Both mainland and island, okay,
yes.
were left behind. The mainland city of Tyre paid a tribute to the Assyrians, and it was not destroyed.
Okay.
When the Babylonians came, they destroyed Jerusalem. They also destroyed mainland Tyre.
Mm-hmm.
That was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And that was a matter of prophecy in Ezekiel.
Right.
Now,
okay.
The island city of Tyre, Tyre was in Asher's territory. All right? The people inhabiting that territory are called Phoenicians by the Greeks, but they were absolutely Israelites.
That's right.
And I wrote papers to prove that, and we've done a radio
yes,
program.
They were paganized Israelites. Yes.
Yes, they were paganized Israelites, but all of Israel was paganized.
Yes.
After the division of the kingdom.
That's right.
And that's recorded right in the Old Testament.
Yeah, all of the 10 northern tribes were paganized, and there was a lot of it going on in Judah as well. Yeah,
absolutely. They were setting up bulls in certain cities, and that's recorded right in the Book of Kings.
Right.
Now, the island of Tyre, which was inhabited by Israelites, mostly of the tribe of Asher, because the city's in Asher's territory,
right.
was never taken by the Assyrians or the Babylonians. And Israelites continued to inhabit it. They were
yes.
never taken away. And they remained famous for their sailing and shipbuilding abilities right down through the Hellenistic era.
Right.
Right down through the time of Alexander.
Yes.
But Alexander destroyed the island city.
Mm-hmm.
However, we can't assume that all those Asherites that were in the island city for all those years between the Babylonian conquest of what the Assyrians left behind in Palestine
yeah.
and the time of Alexander the Great, we can't assume that all those people just sat on that island for 300 years.
Right, yeah.
That's mad. It's 256 years
mm-hmm.
between yeah. the destruction of Jerusalem and Alexander's final destruction of the island of Tyre.
Okay, what's your take then on the end of the Phoenician era? Because, you know, it would probably have ended with Alexander's destruction of Tyre.
Well, you know, Tyre was greatly reduced. What happened was when the Persian king Xerxes wanted to invade Greece and try to conquer Greece. Now, this is at well, it began with the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC.
Okay.
And when the Persian army, a 40,000-man Persian army, got wiped out by an 8,000-man Greek army at the Battle of Marathon, according to the Greek account.
Right.
I mean, the numbers may have been a little closer in reality, but that's according to the Greek account.
Right.
Now, the victors write the history.
They might have had 32,000 slaves that didn't count as men.
Right. Well, that just ticked off Xerxes and Darius. Darius preceded Xerxes. And it strengthened their resolve, and they were resolved to invade and conquer Greece.
Yes.
And they had the Tyrians, the Phoenicians, built a 2,500-ship navy.
Wow.
Okay?
Okay.
In order to invade Greece. And Xerxes brought, according to Herodotus, a 1.8 million-man land army, and that's the numbers probably highly exaggerated.
Right, probably, yeah.
Into Greece. And Xerxes stood on the shore, and the Greeks had a choice. They only had a couple of 100,000 men. So what they did was the Battle of Thermopylae, where 500 Spartans held off the Persian army, the invading Persian army, in this tiny pass.
Yes.
Okay, at Thermopylae. That gave the Athenian Greeks and the people of the mainland Greece the time to take all their wives and old people and children out to an island in the Mediterranean,
okay,
called Salamis. Now, the Greeks had, once they moved all their wives and children out to Salamis, they had a choice, fight the Persians on land or at sea.
Yes.
They couldn't do both. So they chose to fight at sea where they'd have an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
okay,
according to Herodotus, a fleet of maybe 400 or 500 Greek ships destroyed 2,500 Persian ships, which were primarily Phoenicians.
Okay.
They were almost, I mean, they were almost all built by the Phoenicians of Tyre.
Right.
And manned by the Phoenicians of Tyre.
Okay.
And that destroyed Tyre as a power.
Right.
It was never the same again.
Right, right.
When they lost their whole fleet, and actually, when Xerxes stood on the shores of Argos and watched his entire fleet destroyed in a single day, he gave up the fight.
Right.
He
right.
left a quarter of his army behind.
Yes.
And the Greeks eventually defeated them at Potahia and Mycenae and Mycale, I'm sorry. And Xerxes saw his whole navy destroyed. He grabbed three-quarters of his army and marched straight home.
Okay.
He was destroyed. He couldn't deal with it.
I think you would also have to wonder about the loyalty of the Tyrian Phoenicians, because wouldn't they have considered themselves more relatives of the Greeks than of the Persians?
Well, you know, the Persians were very magnanimous. I mean, look at – it was Cyrus the Persian who allowed most of the captives, you know, that all the captives that wanted to,
uh-huh,
to return to Jerusalem.
Okay,
and,
yes.
And his magnanimity didn't end there. I mean, he was quite magnanimous to all of the people who,
yes,
were – I mean, don't get me wrong. Persia was a tyranny.
Yes.
Like any other empire, it required tyranny.
Yes.
However, he was very greatly loved, Cyrus.
And, yes,
and that, you know, there was always an east-west rivalry because the whole world was white.
Yes.
You know, they were all white. The
yes,
Persians are just as white as the Greeks.
Yes.
And I would think that the Tyrians probably, even though they were closer in kinship to the Greeks, you know, in blood relation,
yes,
to the Greeks, they were still they were Easterners.
Right.
You know, and actually, and this is a demonstration of their attitude. Carthage was still pretty much allied and subservient to Tyre at this time.
Okay.
And there were more Greeks inhabiting Sicily than there were in southern Italy than there were inhabiting Greece at this time.
Okay.
In fact, southern Italy was called Magna Graecia.
Okay.
At this time.
Yes.
Greater Greece.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, when the Persians invaded Greece, they were very concerned that the Greeks of Sicily and Italy would come to the aid of the Greeks of the Peloponnesus,
right,
and of Helena, you know, the Greek proper, which is where Attica is, mainland Greece. So what they did was they had the Tyrians have the Carthaginians invade Sicily at the same time.
Okay.
And Carthage invaded Sicily at the same time because Carthage was subservient to Tyre.
Right.
And allied with Tyre, had an allegiance with Tyre, as, you know, Tyre was the mother city of Carthage. Carthage invaded Sicily at the same time that the Persians invaded Greece.
Yes.
And
okay.
And that prevented, even though the Carthaginians got their butts kicked,
yes,
it prevented the Sicilian Greeks and
yes,
and the Greeks of Italy from assisting in Athens and Sparta.
Right, so that part of the Persian plan worked, but the fact that the major battle was fought at sea, that the Persians weren't expecting.
Right, they got wiped out.
Right, well, so it's quite possible that the Phoenician ships weren't built for warfare, but they were simply built for transporting troops.
Well, right, but the Greeks just, you know, they had become the supreme sailors.
Yes.
You know, they had become the better sailors, and I think that maybe, you know, my personal opinion is that there were probably a lot of Canaanites with those Phoenicians.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and we know how good they do at sea.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're good at giving orders. Yes, yeah. Well, I see we only have about 5 minutes left. What I'd like to do here is simply, you know, amplify what you're saying about Israelites of the 10 northern tribes re-inhabiting this territory, because there's a town called Scythopolis, which is actually named after the Scythians. Okay, so the Scythian Israelites came back from the territory known as Scythia, and started this town called Scythopolis.
Right, but by this time they were probably gone.
Okay.
But the city was continued, the name stuck on the city. There were a group of Scythians. Remember that when Israel was deported, Yahweh said he would put a hedge in the way that they couldn't return.
Okay, yes.
And actually, I think this is proof of the hedge.
Okay.
Because some of them did try to return.
Yes.
And
yes,
they actually made it so far as to loot Joppa.
Uh-huh.
And turn around and settle in just north, you know, in the northern part of Galilee.
Right.
And they actually made a little town called Scythopolis.
Right.
And they probably stayed there for no more than a couple of generations.
Okay. And then what about the Gauls, who were Scythians, who are not necessarily Scythians, but Israelites, who were as far as Gaul, and actually some of them came back to, you know, to the territory of Israel as well.
Well, right, and the Gauls came back in the Crusades too.
Yes, right. Yeah. So where did they settle? You know, what part of the territory did the Gauls?
The Galatai did not make it all the way back to Israel.
They didn't. Okay.
No, Galatia is the district that Paul wrote to. The Galatians are those very Celts or Scythians or Cimmerians. I mean, a lot of Israel identity teachers try to separate the Cimmerians from the Scythians.
Uh-huh.
But basically, the Cimmeroi, or the Cimmerians, that's the Assyrian name for the Scythoi, or the Greek Scythians that the Persians called them all Saka.
Right.
And they're all the same people, just with different names.
Yeah, by different,
because
they by
were
different
called,
languages.
Right, in different languages.
Yes.
But they're all the same people.
Right. Okay, so then Galatia is how far from the old territory of Israel? Because
Galatia it inhabited most of the land of the ancient kingdom of Phrygia in central Anatolia.
Okay.
And it's
Turkey?
Yes, it's modern Turkey.
Asia Minor, but would be to the north and west of ancient Israel, in other words.
Right. At that time, Asia Minor was only eastern, what we know is the very eastern part of Turkey.
Okay.
Asia Minor was a Roman province, which was the eastern part of Turkey.
Okay.
And
right.
Galatia was just to the east. I'm sorry, the western part of Turkey.
Yeah.
And Galatia was just to the east of that in central Turkey.
So those Gauls got very close to Israel, but didn't quite make it. In other
right.
words,
they couldn't. Right. And actually, they didn't want to go to Israel,
right,
according to all accounts.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they weren't trying to go to Palestine.
Right.
I know Bertrand Comparé would like to think so.
Okay.
But in truth, okay, these Galatai came down. They were part of the dispersion of Israel known as the Scythians. They came down from what was called Germany, the other side of the Danube.
Yes.
They raided Athens. They looted the Oracle of Apollo, okay?
Uh-huh.
And they tried to conquer Pergamus. And Attalus, the king of Pergamus, defeated them in the battle.
Okay.
And allowed them to inhabit land, which was actually his land.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened in the 3rd century B.C.
Okay.
And he allowed them to inhabit the ancient land of Phrygia that their Cimmerian ancestors had actually destroyed 400 years before that.
Okay.
On their way into Europe.
Right. Okay.
So they destroyed it on their way into Europe, and they came back to live in it
right.
400 years later.
Right. Any indication of what drove these Gauls back from Europe? Back
booty.
Huh?
Booty.
Booty.
The
okay.
whole booty.
War booty.
The Greek cities were loaded with gold.
Oh, okay.
And Pergamus was the seat of Satan. That's where the Greek bankers were.
Right.
That's
right.
Where all the bankers were.
Yeah, a lot of those had to be Canaanites.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
But, that you know, the Greek cities and the Greek temples were virtually loaded with gold.
Yes. Okay. So the Gauls became part of military, not empire, but military, how should I put it, campaigns. That were after that gold.
All the time. That's why they raided Rome. They raided
yes.
Rome for money. They didn't
yes.
raid it because they liked spaghetti.
Or tomatoes. Right. Okay. All right. Very good. I think we can might as well call it quits for today. I had to log off and log back in because my screen froze. And so I had to log back on just so I could end the show. And so now I know for sure that if I log out, the program won't end. That's why if there were any messages in the chat room, I wasn't able to answer them. In any case, I think we've really fairly well established that the opening chapters of Luke confirm that this message, this gospel, was exclusive to Israel in every possible way. We're being told that, you know, these prophecies were made to Israel and fulfilled in Israel. And no other people. Wouldn't that be fair to
think?
There's
no doubt. This is all about Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke knew it, and he was a Greek.
Yes.
And
yes.
And Paul, I mean, Paul talks about my gospel. His gospel is probably the gospel that Luke recorded was the gospel that Paul was bringing to the nations, period.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
There's no doubt, because, I mean, John and Matthew weren't even written yet.
Yes. Yes, okay.
They weren't written when Paul was making his trips to Greece.
Yes, yes. So it's pretty obvious, as we mentioned earlier, that Matthew, Mark, and John, being natives of Galilee and being fishermen and being, you know, very, you'd have to say, local-oriented in their thinking, you know, that they couldn't possibly have made connections to the greater world outside of Galilee and outside of Judea that Luke has established for us here. Yet,
absolutely not.
Yeah,
and Paul.
Yes, and in spite of all that, it's very clear that the message is strictly to Israel and Israelites.
The nations of Israel.
Yes.
And that's what this says. That's what Luke says in 2:32, that the light was for a revelation of the nations of Israel.
Yes, yes. Okay, very good.
And that's the Israel identity message in
yes.
Luke, and you won't find that in the other Gospels. I'm sorry. I
right.
mean, there's glimpses of it in John chapter 7. There's, you know, there's allusions to it, but I mean, this is very clear.
Yes, I agree. Very good. All right, so next time let's get into John chapter 3, and Luke chapter 3. And we'll get into the two genealogies, the comparative genealogies of Matthew and Luke, which give slightly different accounts of, in my opinion, one is the ancestry of Joseph, the father-in-law, or stepfather, I guess stepfather would be the correct terminology, of Yahshua Messiah. And, of course, Mary, who is the literal mother of Messiah, okay?
Absolutely, but first, we will definitely get into the genealogies next week, but first I'd like to make a pit stop at at Luke 3:1 and explain Daniel's 70-week prophecy and some of the things in history going on there.
Yes.
And, okay. And then in Luke 3:7, we have to talk about the race of vipers comment that,
okay.
that John the Baptist made.
Race of vipers?
That's two
Who
C
could
lines.
That be?
And it says race of vipers.
Yeah. All right. Okay, thanks a lot, Bill. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. It was a great, fun show again tonight. And, you know, look forward to get further into the into Luke chapter 3 next Friday. Tomorrow, Yahweh's Covenant People, we're going to continue our discussion of 1 Corinthians. And then Sunday, Greg Howard will be with me on the Voice of Christian Israel. We're going to talk about the Chosen of Enoch, the exclusive message contained in the Book of Enoch, also written exclusively to Israel and no other people. We'll get into that. And I believe we're going to try to cover for Sword Brethren tomorrow at, I guess it's 6, I believe, Eastern Time.
And I thought it was Sunday at 4:30 or something.
And then Sunday as well. So
okay.
Even though Sword Brethren is not able to be a part of those shows, we're going to try to put them on for you Saturday and Sunday. So tune into those as well, okay? So thanks a lot, everybody, for tuning in. It's great fun discovering the truth of Scripture. And I hope you enjoyed the show and the things that we're trying to reveal about the, you know, poor translations and the universalistic translations that the mainstream churches all teach. They're afraid to discuss the truth of the original Greek and the original Hebrew, which are very exclusive, folks, and they're not universalist at all. So thanks for listening, and see you tomorrow. Yahweh bless, everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.